From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, analysis of the coup in the Soviet Union. We talk with Robert Cullen, who writes about the Soviet Union for The Atlantic and The New Yorker. Earlier this summer, he was in Moscow researching an article on the Soviet military. Also today, I talk with film director Paul Mazursky. His movies include Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Moscow on the Hudson, Enemies, A Love Story, and Next Stop Greenwich Village. His latest film, Scenes from a Mall, which just came out on home video, stars the unlikely pair of Bette Midler and Woody Allen. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Alan Parker's new movie, The Commitments. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet tanks rolled into Moscow today to back up the coup that ousted President Mikhail Gorbachev. The troops were met by angry protesters who defied a ban on demonstrations and barricaded key streets around the Russian Parliament building. Even so, the rallies were much smaller than those that have been seen in the past, not only in the capital, but in the secessionist republics. NPR's Ann Cooper explains.
One difference between Moscow and the Baltic republics, where you saw such mass movements and where people are out en masse again today, is that they don't have the kind of strong political organizations that have developed in places like Lithuania, where the ethnic Lithuanians control the government there. And also, I would just say that, you know, there probably are people who think that perhaps this is not such a bad thing, because Mikhail Gorbachev was not a terribly popular president here. He actually was disliked by many people who do blame him for the economic chaos in the country. And some people may welcome anybody who says that they're going to try to restore economic order to the Soviet Union.
NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow. Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin today denounced the Soviet coup and called for a nationwide general strike to protest it. The Russian leader climbed onto a tank in a Moscow street to condemn the ouster of Soviet President Gorbachev. Later, he addressed a rally of about 5,000 people from the Russian Parliament building. Yeltsin said that Gorbachev should be given the opportunity to speak to the people and called for an extraordinary meeting of the Congress of People's Deputies. President Bush interrupted his vacation in Maine to return to the White House today, where he plans to meet with his top foreign policy advisors on the situation in the Soviet Union. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Mr. Bush returned to the White House early this afternoon wearing a business suit and a serious expression as he strode into the Oval Office. The president met with his national security advisor Brent Scowcroft and Robert Gates, Scowcroft's deputy. On the flight to Washington from Maine, Scowcroft ruled out any active U.S. participation in restoring Gorbachev to power.
This is an internal development in the Soviet Union, and it is not something that we are directly engaged in, other than as we react, either, you know, a good government, bad government, so on.
Tomorrow, the president meets with Secretary of State James Baker and swears in Robert Strauss as the new U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union. Strauss is expected to head to Moscow shortly thereafter. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 70 points to close at 2,898. This is NPR. Stock prices in Japan fell by almost 6% today on the news of the political turmoil in the Soviet Union. Analysts said that Japan does relatively little business with the Soviet Union, but that investors were reacting to fears about greater worldwide unrest. The latest plunge in the Tokyo stock market prompted speculation that Japan's central bank may act soon to lower interest rates. Only partial results are in from yesterday's midterm elections in Mexico. They indicate that the ruling party, or PRI, swept the election for members of Congress and six governorships. NPR's Katie Davis reports.
Election results won't be final until later this week, but partial returns are showing that the ruling party won close to 60% of the vote countrywide. Opposition parties, however, are not conceding defeat everywhere. Both major parties, on the right and the left, have made serious accusations of fraud in two closely contested state elections. Today, in the central state of San Luis Potosí, the opposition candidate for governor, Dr. Salvador Nava Martinez, said that Sunday's elections prove that democracy still does not exist in Mexico. Dr. Nava said that he will not take his complaints to local election authorities because, he asserted, they are the same authorities that carried out the vote fraud. He promised to take his case to the people of San Luis Potosí and ask them to defend their vote. I'm Katie Davis in San Luis Potosí, Mexico.
The political struggle in Madagascar intensified today as the opposition party claimed it was taking over the government. President Didier Ratsiraka has been under pressure to resign for almost 3 months in the midst of protest rallies and strikes by his opponents. It was unclear whether the opposition had, in fact, made any move to take over the government. Earlier today, the country's armed forces issued a statement saying that they would support neither Ratsiraka nor the opposition. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Around the world today, people are sharing the same preoccupation, trying to figure out what's going on in the Soviet Union now that Gorbachev is out and the hardliners are in. To help us understand the events behind the coup, we called Robert Cullen. He writes about the Soviet Union for The Atlantic and The New Yorker. He was last there in June researching an article on the Soviet military. He's also written a book on the crumbling Soviet empire that's scheduled for publication in October. We called Cullen earlier today, and he told me that this coup was the worst news he could imagine from the Soviet Union.
I think that there is still hope, however, and I look forward to the next few days with great anticipation because I have the sense that this coup may not work, that the people may rise up against it, and that the average Russian soldier is not going to fire at them.
What would it take for the Russian people to rise up against this coup successfully?
Well, I think you'd have to have massive street demonstrations and a general strike, and either or both is possible. That's what Boris Yeltsin has called for, and one of the things that I find difficult to understand is why the people who brought this coup off did not have the foresight, apparently, to arrest him in his home before he could take an active role in opposing their coup, but they didn't. It suggests that maybe they are overconfident or maybe their forces are not as large or as well organized as they might want us to believe, and therefore Yeltsin still is at large and still able to serve as a rallying point for opposition to the coup, and I think he'll try to do that.
Do you think you'll maybe wake up tomorrow morning and find out Yeltsin has been arrested?
It's quite possible. That's certainly, if I were running the coup, that would be the first item on my list, is get him out of circulation, because he's the only politician in the Soviet Union within Russia with a valid claim on popular legitimacy. And if he's allowed to remain at large and allowed to organize opposition, I think it's quite possible that you could see not only people out on the streets, but severe divisions within the army. It's quite worth noting, I think, that in June, when the Russian Republic held its presidential election, the high command of the army, which is known in Russian as the Verkhushka, openly supported Nikolai Ryzhkov, who was the old prime minister under Gorbachev, and Boris Gromov, who was a hardline general, the last Soviet officer in Afghanistan, and now is the deputy minister of internal affairs, a position that gives him command over the internal affairs troops in the country. And those people did not even get a majority of support within the army. The bulk of the officer corps voted for Yeltsin and his running mate, Colonel Alexander Rutskoy, who is in fact an Afghan war hero who has joined a growing movement of officers toward the democratic side of the Soviet political spectrum. And if Yeltsin can set himself up as a standard to rally around, I think a fair number of the officers in the Soviet Army, particularly the junior officers and middle-ranking officers, might well be tempted to join him.
Can you tell how much military support there is for the coup and how much communication there was between the leaders of the coup and the military there was before the coup actually happened?
Well, it's impossible to know at the moment. It would be very interesting if we could get some information, which so far I have not seen, about which particular units are involved in the takeover of key government buildings and so forth in Moscow. My suspicion is that these are elite units, of which there are a relatively small number in the Soviet Army, and that they have not asked the rank-and-file conscripts to take part in this operation as yet.
Because they're afraid of the alienation they might feel?
Because they can't trust that the rank-and-file conscripts are going to shoot in this kind of a situation. For one thing, a fairly significant percentage of them come from non-Russian republics and probably see this coup correctly as an effort to prevent their own republics from ever gaining any kind of independence from Moscow. And for another, the young people in the country have, I think, as much as anybody else, been changed by Glasnost and are not the kind of young people anymore who will blindly follow communist leadership. So that rank-and-file draftees, I don't think, are going to be reliable forces for the Army in the days ahead. They're going to rely initially on elite units, which have been picked, if for nothing else, for their fluency in the Russian language, which tends to eliminate a lot of the non-Russian nationalities, and have been indoctrinated to believe that they are doing the right thing. How long that indoctrination will hold if babushki are coming up to them in the streets and berating them for betraying their mothers and fathers is another question. I was in Romania shortly after the coup in December 1989, which removed Nicolae Ceausescu. And it was apparent then that the key element was that when Ceausescu had to call on the draftees to fire in his behalf, they wouldn't fire.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Robert Cullen, and he's a Soviet expert who's written extensively about the Soviet Union for The New Yorker and The Atlantic magazines, and he's the author of a forthcoming book called Twilight of Empire, Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc. Gorbachev had lost popular support before the coup. Do you think that there might be a surprising amount of support for the coup because it got rid of Gorbachev?
Well, I asked that question in Moscow in June at the All-Union Center for Public Opinion Research, and it is exactly correct that Gorbachev had miserable public support ratings, 7% in the latest poll that they had taken. But they had also asked people about their attitudes toward the army and about their attitudes toward a military coup. Support for the army as an institution had been dropping steadily since April 89, when the army intervened in a demonstration in Tbilisi and killed a number of Georgians. And it had dropped to about 35% of the population being willing to say that they trusted the army. They asked whether the people would support a military coup, and a very small minority said that they would immediately support a military coup, about 14 or 15%. Another 10 or 15% said that they might at some point in the future support a military coup. The rest of the people that were asked were resolutely opposed to it. So I think you're seeing that a minority of the population might support this coup. Certainly a very tiny minority within the intellectual community, principally the extreme Russian nationalists. No one of any consequence, I don't think, in any of the republics outside of the party nomenclatura. So I think you're going to find that the new leaders of the Kremlin may have trouble extending their writ much past Moscow's city limits.
The coup happened one day before the Union Treaty that would have given more autonomy to the Soviet republics. You've been studying the Soviet republics and their independence movements. What would this treaty have accomplished?
Well, it's not clear because the treaty itself was a little ambiguous, and I would think that the fact that took place a day before that treaty was to be signed may not have been as significant as the fact that it took place in August, which is the month when Soviet leaders traditionally take their vacation in the Crimea, and not coincidentally the month when Nikita Khrushchev was overthrown. But the Union Treaty would have given a significant amount of the power of the purse over to the republic governments. The government was supposed to be structured in such a way that the republics would have the power to tax, and they would then remit a certain percentage of their tax revenues to the central government. To be honest, I thought that the Union Treaty was a recipe for financial chaos, because I can't conceive of a situation where the republic governments will get together and agree on a fiscally sound central policy that would prevent inflation and prevent the ruinous printing of currency that has already begun in the Soviet Union. And I think the military saw that as a direct threat to its ability to command resources and maintain its force levels at a number that the high command considers reasonable, which is a lot higher than the reformers in the republics think.
What do you think the coup will mean for the future of the independence movements?
Well, for the immediate future, unless the coup is reversed, I think that one of the first items on the agenda of the military government will be to suppress those movements. One of the things that remains to be seen is whether they can do that in a place like Georgia or Armenia, where the population is well-armed and prepared to resist. But clearly, I think the military wants to suppress those independence movements and will try to do so. In the long run, I don't think that can happen. But in the short run, I think you can certainly expect to see some arrests, probably, unfortunately, some bloodshed.
What do you think the coup is going to mean for the START Treaty and for the Middle East Peace Conference, which the Soviet Union had agreed to co-host with the United States?
Well, until it becomes more clear how successful this coup will be and what the policies of the new government will be, I think that it would be impossible to make any predictions about what's going to happen in Soviet international policy. Obviously, there are some severe potential problems. There are troops that have yet to withdraw from Germany, troops that have yet to withdraw from Poland, and so on. And what happens to those troops is going to be of prime concern, I think, in the next 6 months. My guess would be that the START Treaty will face a much more difficult time in the Senate if we're looking at a Soviet Union that appears possibly going back to the kinds of policies that prevailed under Brezhnev. But it might go through if the new government suggests that it's likely to continue to try to follow the same basic line Gorbachev had. I don't think you'll see any improvement in economics. The trade agreement, which President Bush just sent up to the Congress a couple of weeks ago, is dead in the water as far as normal tariffs for the Soviet Union and so on are concerned. I think the peace conference is also going to be dead in the water. It's such a touchy thing that I can't imagine the United States being interested in anything that would allow this new government, assuming it stays in power, to have a major role in the Middle East. And I can't imagine that the Israelis will feel very confident about going forward under this new government.
What are you looking to President Bush to do right now?
I think that there's one obvious thing that he can do, and that is to make it very clear to the men who have taken power in Moscow that they will get no economic cooperation from the West as long as they continue to try to resist a legitimate government. Either they return Gorbachev to power or they have elections where Yeltsin and other people can freely vie for power, or they face the prospect of getting no aid. And I don't think they can survive under those circumstances indefinitely. Their credit is totally used up in the West. They can't get any loans from Western banks without government backing. And unless they get those loans for grain, for industrial equipment and so forth, their chances of reviving the Soviet economy are basically nil, because they are not going to have enough popular support to get people to work enthusiastically at their present jobs. And I think that they're going to realize that, and in the long run, that's going to be very important in their calculations. So I think that it's important. If I were advising President Bush, what I would do would be to tell him that he should get, as I think he's probably going to do, this is an obvious step, it doesn't take a genius to figure it out, he should get Cole, Mitterrand, Major, and the Japanese and so forth together and issue a joint statement, basically cutting the Soviets off as long as this government is in power. No credits, no aid, no help whatsoever. And I think that would put a fair amount of pressure on the coup leadership to do something to regain some legitimacy in the eyes of the West. They're in a very weak position in the Soviet Union right now. Their credit is gone. They can't borrow money on their own. And they're not well placed to run the country indefinitely without outside assistance.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Robert Cullen, author of the forthcoming book, October Twilight of Empire, Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc, and he's been writing for years about the Soviet Union. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the coup in the Soviet Union. My guest Robert Cullen writes extensively about the Soviet Union, and his recent articles have appeared in The New Yorker and The Atlantic magazines. Is this the end of the end of the Cold War? Do you think that this indicates the Cold War might start again?
In the short run, possibly. In the long run, no. The only real precedent for what's going on here, I think, is probably what happened in Poland in 1981. When General Jaruzelski took power and tried to banish Solidarity. And it was a losing battle in the long run, even though in the short run he did manage to put Lech Wałęsa and a number of people in jail. In the long run, he could not survive without popular support and without the Soviets being willing to prop him up. He realized that and turned over power to Solidarity in a peaceful process. And I think that the same will be true of these people. They cannot survive indefinitely without some kind of support, and nobody in the Soviet Union anymore believes that they have any answers to the problems that the country has. So I think that within a period of time that's difficult to predict, but maybe as short as 6 months or a year, maybe a few weeks, that their time will pass. And while I would not rule out anything at the moment, I think that in the medium term at least, the democratic forces will regain the initiative and try to put the country back on the path that it was following, however fitfully, under Gorbachev's leadership. What happens to Gorbachev is anybody's guess. Obviously, they have it in their power to kill him. It doesn't appear that they've done so at this point. They would lose a tremendous amount if they did kill him, because his death would no doubt stigmatize them forever in the minds of other world leaders and in world opinion, and make the Soviet Union a pariah state as long as they were in command. I think that they understand that, and for that reason they will try to keep Gorbachev under house arrest until they've established some semblance of order. They'll probably try to do some things to rally some popular support. They might, for example, put on trial some people who they will accuse of speculating in scarce goods and so forth, who will serve as scapegoats for the economic problems, and they will try to, through an infusion of discipline and so forth, give a little boost to production. If there are any stores of grain and food somewhere that the government has hidden away, I'm sure they'll appear at the right time on the store shelves. But I don't think that in the long run, any longer people are prepared to believe that these people have the answer. One of the things that Glasnost has done over the last 5 years has been to change a lot of the opinions of people in the Soviet Union. When I was in Moscow in June, I talked to a member of the parliament, a colonel in the Air Force, a test pilot, one of the top test pilots in the Air Force, the kind of man that you would expect to be a conservative based on the way test pilots normally are in most countries. And he told me that his whole way of thinking had changed a little bit after he read 1984, which was published finally in the Soviet Union a couple of years ago. You can't make that man unread that book. The ideas that he has picked up from the period of Glasnost are in his head, and they're not going anywhere. And as long as that's the case, I think that there's a good chance that people of goodwill will triumph in the end. Excuse me, I'm getting a little caught up in what I'm saying. It's a terrible thing that's going on over there.
You have a lot of friends in the Soviet Union, and you're wondering about them now?
Yes. I think they'll all be safe. At least I hope so. It's hard to say. I'm hoping that these people will attempt to do this, as I said, as nonviolently as possible, as rationally as possible, and that they'll realize after a while that the people don't support them and that they can't go on without popular support. But it's anybody's guess as to what can happen.
You know, something I think a lot of American journalists must be thinking about now is what happens to all of the sources who they've quoted in the past few years, the men and women who were so openly supporting the reforms of the past few years. You know, might there be a crackdown against them now? Might they have to pay consequences for having spoken as they did?
It's certainly possible. But again, there may be some safety in numbers. For the average person who has been quoted, they must have files hundreds of feet thick of people of that type who have said something negative about the old regime or the security forces. I suspect that their ability to take reprisals against people will be limited to people like Yeltsin and President Landsbergis in Lithuania and so on, who have been the leaders of the anti-central government movement, and to people like former Foreign Minister Shevardnadze, who I think is roundly hated by the military for some of the agreements that he made while he was Foreign Minister. Those are the people at risk right now. It would be a true nightmare if it got to the point that the average person whom I know or people who spoke to us, journalists, were in jeopardy. But it's impossible to say that won't happen. I just don't think that it will.
Now, what's your story now? You're trying to get back into the Soviet Union?
Well, I'd like to go as soon as I can. I'm applying for a visa today, and I'll see what happens. But I'm hopeful that the military's control of the government is not such yet that they control the foreign ministry and the in-tourist agency that issue the visas. It may be that if I move fast, I'll be able to get in there before they can establish control over those kinds of agencies.
So that's a real concern, that if you don't move fast enough, it might be really difficult to get in.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's the best case scenario? How soon would you be going?
Thursday.
Wow.
Under any circumstances, it takes the Soviet bureaucracy that long to process a visa request. So that's when I've made a reservation, and that's when I'm hoping to get a visa.
Robert Cullen, thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with your plans to get back into the Soviet Union.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Robert Cullen is the author of the forthcoming book, Twilight of Empire, Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc. He spoke to us earlier today from his home outside Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You probably know Paul Mazursky as the director of Scenes from a Mall, Moscow on the Hudson, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, and Enemies, a Love Story. But you might not know that Mazursky is a former stand-up comic and one of the creators of The Monkees. Coming up, we find out a few more little-known facts about Paul Mazursky. A few years ago, Alan Parker dramatized a chapter of the civil rights movement in his movie Mississippi Burning. His new movie is based on a novel about a band of Irish rockers who emulate black soul musicians. It's called The Commitments, and Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is back in Washington tonight for meetings concerning the ouster of Soviet leader Gorbachev. Late this afternoon, Mr. Bush called the Soviet coup misguided and not legitimate. In a White House statement, Mr. Bush said that the U.S. will avoid in every possible way actions that would lend support to this coup effort. In Moscow, Soviet tanks have moved into the center of the capital. Nicholas Palugin reports from Moscow.
As night fell, residents of Moscow continued to man blockades of cement slabs and buses throughout the city in an effort to impede the movement of troops. At the Russian parliament, 10 army tanks flying white, blue, and red Russian national flags took up positions to defend the building from forces loyal to hardline communists. In Leningrad, Mayor Anatoly Sobchak appeared to remain in control of the city, and a massive demonstration was held on the plaza from which the Bolsheviks stormed the Winter Palace in 1917. Siberian coal miners responded quickly to events by declaring strikes at individual mines. Union leaders are predicting the work stoppage will spread Tuesday. Amid the confusion, Russian President Boris Yeltsin appears to be leading the opposition. Mr. Yeltsin today called for a general strike and is planning a mass rally for midday Tuesday near the Kremlin. For National Public Radio, this is Nicholas Pilugin in Moscow.
Government leaders around the world were stunned by the news of Gorbachev's ouster. In Europe, a special NATO session was convened to discuss the crisis, and foreign ministers of the 12 European Community countries scheduled a meeting for tomorrow. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Berlin.
The changes Mikhail Gorbachev encouraged or simply permitted changed the face of Europe, ended the Cold War, and raised hopes for peace and cooperation. So the word he'd been ousted by his enemies was deeply alarming. British Prime Minister John Major charged that Gorbachev was removed from office unconstitutionally. German Chancellor Helmut Kohl cut short his vacation and rushed back to Bonn today when he learned of the coup. At a news conference this afternoon, Kohl admonished the new Soviet leaders to abide by their international commitments, and he warned that continued German aid to the Soviet Union would depend in part on whether Gorbachev's personal safety is guaranteed. Kohl and other German leaders are deeply grateful to Gorbachev for having allowed the unification of their country and agreed to the removal of Soviet troops from German territory. A Soviet army commander here, however, promised today that the troop withdrawals will continue as planned, regardless of what happens in Moscow. I'm Tom Gelton in Berlin.
Commercial air traffic is said to be operating normally in and out of Moscow. A spokesman for Pan Am said today that the airline's flight from New York City to Moscow was keeping on schedule and was expected to land in Moscow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials dropped 70 points to close at 2,898.03, volume 230 million shares. This is NPR News. According to a Latvian radio report, one man was killed and another man was wounded when Soviet troops fired on a minibus in the capital of Latvia. Witnesses were quoted as saying that the two men apparently drove into a roped-off area. In January, more than 20 people were killed in a crackdown by Kremlin-run forces. Israeli officials have expressed the hope that the Soviet Union will not change its policy towards Soviet Jewish immigration. Patricia Golan reports that Israeli immigration officials say that there are no indications so far that restrictions on leaving the Soviet Union will be reimposed.
There are currently about 65,000 Jews in the Soviet Union holding exit visas permitting them to leave and go to Israel. Cautious speculation here is that the changes in the Soviet Union will not affect immigration figures, and officials say there's no reason to panic. But Jewish agency head Simcha Dinitz assumes there will be more Soviet Jews asking to leave.
It is an ironclad rule that whenever there is discomfort or disintegration of authority or a change in the political structure, minorities are usually apprehensive, and Jews among them are the first.
Dinitz said authorities are equipped to handle whatever numbers come. Palestinians, on the other hand, voiced hopes today that the new leadership in Moscow would close the gates to Jewish emigration. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Hurricane Bob moved into the northeast this afternoon, leaving hundreds of thousands of people without power. But the National Weather Service says this storm lost some power as it drew close to Portland, Maine. The hurricane is moving now at about 40 miles an hour. The storm battered coastal areas with heavy rain and strong winds that knocked down countless trees and power lines. There are unconfirmed reports that at least two people have been killed by the storm. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, next stop Greenwich Village, an unmarried woman, Moscow on the Hudson, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Harry and Tonto, Moon Over Parador, and Enemies, a Love Story, are just some of the movies directed by my guest, Paul Mazursky. His latest movie, Scenes from a Mall, just came out on video. I spoke with Mazursky last February when the movie opened in theaters. In Scenes from a Mall, Woody Allen and Bette Midler play a couple about to celebrate their 16th wedding anniversary with a big dinner party in their Beverly Hills home. Who would have thought of casting the introspective, cerebral Woody Allen opposite the extroverted and brassy Bette Midler? I asked Mazursky why he brought these two opposites together.
It's a fair question, and many people ask me, but I have a variety of answers. One is that most marriages that I've known, and I've been married a long time and have known a lot of married people, you wonder how they got together. Often they seem to be opposites. You know, the guy's a baseball fan and watches football and this and that, and the woman has no interest in it. I've rarely met couples who are, they both love to do everything together, you know, that
right.
kind of thing. So that I found perfectly normal. Secondly, it seemed at the time, and I still think it's a good idea, to try to match these two, you know, famous people who you would not think would be together, just to see what would happen.
This is Woody Allen's first role in another director's film since The Front. Was he initially enthusiastic about this? Did you have
yes.
to sell him on it?
No. I called Sam Cohen, who's my agent and is his agent. I said, I have a script. He said, well, I know the script. I said, you think Woody might be interested? He said, he might. He's looking for a job. He wants to work in another person's movie to make money. Sent him the script on Saturday. On Monday, he called and said he wants to do it. That's how easy it was.
So what did you tell Woody Allen about how you wanted him to act compared to the kind of character he usually plays in his own
well,
movies?
Well, I didn't tell him how I wanted him to act. I told him I wanted a ponytail, and at first he was resistant, but then...
I could see why.
why do you say that? Tell me.
Well, there's something so trendy about that kind of ponytail now.
Right. I wanted him to be trendy. I wanted
right.
him to be someone other than the Woody Allen you see in Woody Allen movies.
Yeah, he's very stylish in this, very clothes conscious.
I wanted him to be trendy. I wanted him to be, you know, someone who, while he's from New York, and you can't pretend he's not, has been in L.A. a long time and has picked up some of the moonwalker and silly, crazy, trendy things, which that's a whole topic you and I could talk about, because as trendy as L.A. is, and I think it is, I think New York is I see ponytails all over the joint here. I mean,
New York, absolutely.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
It's Ponytail City. I mean, you don't know if it's horses or people. Woody will say to you, I'm not really an actor. I just play this person, so I can't cry and I can't do this. But he is an actor. The person he played in Crimes and Misdemeanors is not the same person he played in Broadway Danny Rose. And that's not the same person he played in Annie Hall.
Now, you started off doing stand-up comedy, right?
I was a nightclub comic in New York. I worked clubs that some of which you'll know, the Village Vanguard, the Bonsoir, the Ruben Blue, the 15th Avenue, upstairs or the downstairs. That was the time of Mike Nichols, Elaine May, Lenny Bruce, Jonathan Winters. And I had a partner named Herb Hartig, and we were called Igor and H.
Why?
Well, I was Igor and he was H. Who knows, you know, we had a funny name. We didn't want to say Hartig and Mazursky, although maybe we should have. And then I broke up with Herb and I did the act myself for about 3 years and ended up in Los Angeles.
What kind of comics were you exposed to when you were growing up? Did you go to the Borscht Belt a lot? See the Jewish comics like Myron Cohn?
I did go to the Borscht Belt a lot. And as a matter of fact, I played Storyville, a place in Boston that's mostly jazz, as a comic myself. And I was on the bill with Roberta Sherwood and Myron Cohn. I followed Myron Cohn. In other words, he was finishing his 4 weeks, and then I followed. And he was a great raconteur and told those long stories. You know, Schwartz came up to his best friend and said, you know, what is a good Shabbos to you? And those jokes, you know. You know, Schwartz meets Cohn in the garment district. He says, I heard about the fire. Shh, tomorrow. That was not my joke. That was I used to tell that joke to whenever I get into trouble. So I worked at Catskills for 5 years as a waiter, and on the weekends in some of the places they were so broke that I was the social director and did a combination of comedy and Shakespeare, I swear.
Like what?
Well, I would make up funny things. I would imitate famous people, but give them names of customers who I knew were at the hotel. For example, I would do like Clark Gable. Now look here, Mrs. Schwartz. I know your flunking is well done, but I'm going to tell you right now that I've got no control over our head waiter, Edward G. Robinson. Now listen here, Mrs. Schwartz, that flunking is not well done. Well, I would mention the names of the people in the hotel. You just say their name. They would plots, which in Yiddish means die, fall on the floor, hit, kick each other. And then when I would finish about 40 minutes of that, I would do a soliloquy from Hamlet. to give them, you know, culture. And they loved it. They would cry. Such a nice boy, they would say. I should make a movie about all that. It was funny as hell.
Oh, that sounds great.
And it worked. I would do Peter Lorre as the angry busboy, you know? Hey, I can't find you. You got dirt all over my tray. You know, and it was a joke, but it was funny. That was probably funnier than my nightclub act.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is screenwriter and director and actor Paul Mazursky, and his new movie, Scenes from a Mall, co-stars Bette Midler and Woody Allen, with Paul Mazursky in a little cameo part. He also directed Enemies of Love Story, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Moscow on the Hudson, Bob and Carol on Ted and Alice, Next Stop Greenwich Village, and Unmarried Woman, and Harry and Tonto. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Film director Paul Mazursky is my guest. Now, one of your early movies, Next Stop Greenwich Village, is about a boy from Brooklyn who moves to Greenwich Village hoping to become an actor.
Yeah.
It's set in 1953. Is this autobiographical?
Yes. Everything that I do has some autobiographical stuff in it, even the ones they don't know. But that was more. That was definitely more. That was sort of a memoir of my last year in Brooklyn and my first year in Greenwich Village. And it's sort of, you know, I took many events that happened and some events that didn't happen and fooled around with them. It's not literal at all times. It really isn't.
Did you have a Shelley Winters kind of mother?
I did.
Domineering
I did.
Mother?
I did. I had a very... I was thinking this morning, as a matter of fact, when I was sitting in a steam room in a hotel, of a book that I might write someday, because maybe the time is coming close. And I was thinking of chapters, and they would all be names of the people that were influential in my life. And the first one, of course, would be Jean, who was my mother.
I don't know if your mother's still alive, but...
No, she's not.
Did she live to see any of your movies?
She saw Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. She was at the opening in New York at the New York Film Festival.
Oh, great. The one about sex. Perfect.
The one about sex. And she sat there with me and Natalie Wood and my wife and Bob Culp and Elliot Gould and Diane Cannon and Mayor Lindsay. And when it was over, she said to me, "Oh, so don't be such a big shot." That was my mother's... You know what I mean?
I sure do, yeah.
I mean, she was powerful and funny, and I had a lot of trouble with her. But she was definitely... I would guess that, you know, the source of my pain and inspiration at the same time with the movies. But I, you know, I now that it's all so many years ago, I think about it with great affection. At the time, I was afraid of her. I really was.
Was it hard to leave her and to go to the West Coast?
That was a relief.
Mm-hmm.
The West Coast was, oh, boy, I did it. I'm free. But she soon found her way out there.
Oh, really?
And then she said to me, I don't like it. It's a lot of palm trees. And she went back. She didn't want to stay there.
Director Paul Mazursky is my guest. Did you co-create The Monkees, the TV
show?
Yes.
I with Larry Tucker.
What was your contribution to it?
Well, Larry and I were writing for Danny Kaye, which was on in the early 63, 4, 5, 6. And we were approached by Bert Schneider and Bob Ravelson, who knew we were very funny, or heard we were funny, and quote, hip, unquote. And they said, look, we want to do a show, a TV, half-hour TV show that's in the style of the Beatles, of Help, of those movies. So we went and looked at a couple of the movies, and we wrote this one episode and called it The Monkees, and our names are on it. And then we had a lot of lawsuits later because that was before the Writers Guild gave you separation of rights in a protected way. And when the thing started selling a lot of socks and toys and monkey T-shirts, they said they created it. They gave us the name Monkees. And we said, no, you didn't. And had a lot of arguing.
Do you look back at the monkey shows and say, hey, that was really pretty good? Or do you look back and laugh and go, what a knockoff?
Now, I look back and say we would not have written it if they hadn't come to us. We didn't invent the style because the Beatles did. But all things considered, it was a pretty far-out thing for television. And it had a lot of crazy style, and it had energy. And we saw something. I'm sort of proud of it. You know, of course, it's an odd feeling when people come up to me and say, are you Paul Mazursky? I say, yes. They said, we love your work. And I say, oh, well, thank you. And I'm positive they can say something about the Holocaust or Moon Over Parador, or they say, hey, we're the Monkees. So, you know.
You changed your name from Irwin to Paul.
Wouldn't you?
You didn't like the name Irwin. It's an older generation to
no,
you?
No, Irwin was my name, Irwin Mazursky, and there was a play called Three Men on a Horse, and the main character was Irwin. And he was a nerd, you know, Irwin. And my mother used to come out in Brooklyn, always like Jerry Lewis, it sounds to me now, and called for me. I was playing punch ball in the street or something. Irwin! I hated it. Had she called me Yisrael or something, Israel, son of God, I probably would have liked it. So in 1951, when I was graduating from college, I got into Stanley Kubrick's first film. He didn't know he was Stanley Kubrick. I didn't know who I was. I was Irwin Mazursky. It's called Fear and Desire. And a year or so later, the woman who later became my wife, Betsy, called me and said, you've got to come up with a name. They're putting the titles on Fear and Desire. And Kubrick called her to call me. Do you want to use Irwin Mazursky? I said, And I was in a phone booth in the Catskills, you know. And I said, well, I hate Irwin, but I don't want to give up Mazursky. I like Mazursky. What about Bart Mazursky? Clark Mazursky? What about Humphrey Mazursky? And I started going through. I said, this is true. This is funnier than my movies. I should do all of this. Anyway, finally, the operator said, you know, your 3 minutes is up. And she said, what about my father's name, Purdy? I said, what about Paul Purdy? The operator said, and your time, and I said, Paul Mazursky, and I hung up, and that was it.
That's great.
It's a true story.
Which is on your credit cards and everything. Are you
Paul Mazursky, but on my passport it says Irwin L. Mazursky, a.k.a. Paul Mazursky. So when I go to strange places, they don't know the difference. Sometimes it says Paul. I'm Paul Mazursky.
I want to ask you a little bit about your approach to casting. I think you've come up with a lot of really interesting actors over the years in your movies.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in on that yourself, the casting?
I cast in all movies.
Yeah.
I cast extras.
Oh, really?
I'm compulsive about it. I have help. I have wonderful casting directors. But I am the person who casts every part. Every part. From the top to the bottom, from the beginning to the end.
Well, you know, you hear stories about, like, Robert Altman. An actor just walks into his office, and Altman just talks with him a few minutes and knows if they want to use the actor or not. That's not your approach, is it?
Sometimes. sometimes it is. I've had different approaches. I'll tell you what they are real quickly. Sometimes I've just seen an actor in a film, and I know from that film that they can do what I want, but I just want to meet them in the flesh, and often with big parts. Lena Olin, I saw in The Unbearable Lightness of Being. I flew to London to meet her. I met her with her clothes on, and I still gave her the part. Margaret Stein, the Polish actress who played Jadwiga, I read her. Someone told me about her, and she read for me for about 20, 30 minutes. I gave her the part. Sometimes, next up, Greenwich Village, I read every kid living for that part and finally ended up with Lenny Baker. So I do different things. Once in a while, I was taking a cab to Marion Dougherty's office, the casting director's office, and the cab driver was a woman. She talked so much and was so amusing that I said to her, "Do you think you could act?" She says, "Why not? I mean, I'm driving this piece of junk." So we parked the cab, let the meter run. She came in and read for me. And I gave her the part as the cab driver in Harry and Tonto.
We're just about out of time. I have one more question for you, though. Do you end up doing a lot of stand-up on the set when you're directing?
Yeah. Yeah, I do a lot of it. It's the only time I do it. I lose all of my, inhibitions and have a lot of fun. And I really enjoy it. I like to be funny. To cover the deep, powerful pain.
The miserable insecurity.
The miserable insecurity. Now, I do it for a lot of reasons, but I didn't think I would do it in the Woody Allen Bette Midler movie.
Oh, sure, because here you have like two people who are still doing comedy.
Well, yeah, Woody, I said, I'm not doing it with Woody. He's going to give me weird. But I started doing it, and he used to laugh. He used to put his hand over his mouth. He could not stop laughing at me. So we had a lot of fun. And I've enjoyed myself. Quite a thrilling career, meeting wonderful Natalie Wood and Fellini and Jean Moreau and Donald Sutherland and Isaac Singer. And, these are icons. Marvin Icon I met. I tell you, as a man, if you've ever met him, you're just such a great man.
It's really been a pleasure talking with you. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us on the show.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Paul Mazursky's latest movie is Scenes from a Mall. It just came out on video. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, how are you covering the coup in the Soviet Union?
Oh, we're hearing from Ann Cooper about today's news conference at which Gennady Anayev, the acting president, said that Mikhail Gorbachev is in poor health, very tired, and in treatment somewhere in the south of the country. But there's been no official word from Gorbachev himself and no medical bulletin about his condition. Also, what Muscovites are saying today, we'll also hear from a Soviet journalist, from former White House advisor on Soviet affairs Condoleezza Rice, and from Soviet expert Peter Redaway about what led to the coup, a coup which, by the way, Redaway had predicted.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Alan Parker has kept busy lately making political dramas like Mississippi Burning and Come See the Paradise. But he's always had a passion for musicals, from Bugsy Malone, his first feature, to Fame, his biggest hit. Parker's new movie, The Commitments, is about an Irish rock band. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
It could almost be Fame all over again. Sweet adolescent kids singing in the streets, trading cutesy quips, getting in and out of harmless little scrapes. The dialogue in The Commitments is just as banal as the dialogue in Fame, and the jokes may remind you of some lost episode of the Monkees TV show. And yet, The Commitments has something that saves it from seeming synthetic and manipulative like its predecessors. Call it blarney. This movie gets away with 1,000 aesthetic crimes because its scrappy Irishness is just about irresistible. Alan Parker has a terrific time filming the rubbly streets and bleak alleys of North Dublin, and even though his characters are cardboard, the amateur Irish performers who play them have an almost documentary authenticity. When these kids call each other tossers and wankers and gobshites in their mulligan stew accents, the exoticism of it all really works. The actors aren't up-and-coming thespians like the shiny little creatures who made Fame feel so show-busy. They're mostly fledgling musicians, and some of them, especially the singers, are genuinely skilled. Still, when all is said and done, this movie isn't up to much. It's the story of Jimmy Rabbit, a teen with a dream, played by Robert Arkins. He wants to form and manage a rock group, and not just any rock group. His blueprint for a band called The Commitments becomes clear when he shows his guitarist and bass player a videotape of James Brown screeching his heart out.
That's what you got to measure up to, lads.
Do you not think, well, like, maybe we're a little white for that kind of thing?
Do you not get it, lads? The Irish are the blacks of Europe, and Dubliners are the blacks of Ireland, and the Northside Dubliners are the blacks of Dublin. So say it once, say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud.
The plot couldn't be simpler. Jimmy holds auditions, picks his band members, and then it's practice, practice, practice. The band starts out lousy and gets better. And the only question is, will the beautiful music they make on stage keep them together, or will their backstage discord pull them apart? Parker has moments of inspiration, especially in his handling of the band's lead singer, Deco, played by the remarkable 16-year-old Andrew Strong. Strong looks about 35 and has the voice and even the flailing stage presence of a latter-day Joe Cocker. His charisma is the real thing, but instead of making him a hero offstage, Parker turns him into a dim-witted, egomaniacal slob, at once the least attractive character in the movie and the most talented. That's an unusual approach, but Parker doesn't bring much else to the table. His film is all surface, which wouldn't be so bad, except Parker wants to convince us that something deeper and richer is going on here. He seems to be thunderstruck that a gaggle of white underclass kids from the UK should be playing American soul music. But where's he been for the last 30 years or so? Did he miss out on the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Van Morrison, and 100 other British or Irish groups who made their names doing much the same thing before moving on to something more original? The Commitments never do move on. These guys can rock, but they would never amount to anything more than a pleasant but forgettable bar band. Their soul is borrowed. Unfortunately, so is the movies.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Ajiva Blytus and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. And we'd like to welcome the listeners of WAMU in Washington, D.C., which just added Fresh Air to its program schedule. And if you're a new listener or an old listener, you can call us with your comments about Fresh Air at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's toll-free, 1-800-NPR-WHYY. I'm Terry Gross. You're doing the monkey.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, labor lawyer Thomas Gagan examines the state of unions in the 90s. Also, we meet Joel Hodgson, the creator and star of the cable series Mystery Science Theater 3000. He shows really bad movies and makes nearly frame-by-frame wisecracks about them. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.